This podcast is brought to you by The Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to The Village of Bedford Park.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's 12:03 on Wednesday afternoon, July 30th. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rob Hart. There are some steps you can take to put together a resume that can help you land a job regardless of your age. We'll learn more in our next segment, but right now, there's a lot of key data out today as the economy grew faster than expected, private hiring rebounded, and the Fed plans to stand pat on interest rates. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Diane Swonk, Chief Economist, KPMG in Chicago. Diane, thank you for joining us today. The first read of second quarter gross domestic products shows the economy grew at a 3% rate in the second quarter. That was better than expected. And Diane, is there more to this story than number go up?
Yes, there is, unfortunately, and that is that we saw tariffs really whipsaw growth between the first and the second quarter. We had the largest widening of the trade deficit on record as firms scrambled to get imports in the door by March ahead of tariffs that came in the second quarter. And then imports plummeted, and that helped to buoy growth in the second quarter. So that's part of the reason we saw growth go from a negative in the first quarter, which it wasn't really, to a positive. But underlying growth is less than half of what we saw in the second half of last year. We're seeing domestic spending slow quite dramatically on everything from consumer spending to homes to investment. And that's very important because that weakening in underlying growth is occurring at the same time implicit in today's data is the PCE index. That's what the Fed targets for the month of June. We get the official data tomorrow, but the implied number now suggests that in June, the PCE index accelerated quite sharply in both goods and services, with some contagion of tariff increases showing up in the service sector as well. And that's yet more reason for the Fed to stay on the sidelines in the month of July and wait for more economic data before they make a decision on when to cut rates. That doesn't mean there won't be a dissent at this meeting. Two governors have said they may be willing to dissent, one all but promising in it, worrying that the drag on underlying growth could be greater from tariffs than the bump in inflation due to tariffs.
And then when what kind of a picture does this paint of an economy moving forward, where when a lot of these Liberation Day effects are smoothed out?
Well, when we look at it, it shows an economy that's slowing, an economy that slowed quite dramatically from what we saw in the latter part of 2024, an economy that has also slowed down in terms of employment. We saw the ADP report was a little better today, but it's still very subdued compared to the pace of hiring we've seen. There's very little margin for error in the labor market, and that's important as well. What we have is a pace of hiring that's below 2019 levels, a pace of quits that's below 2019 levels, and thus far layoffs remain low. If we were to see any change in layoffs, that could be cause a very rapid spike in unemployment.
Diane Swonk, Chief Economist, KPMG in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today to break down the second quarter gross domestic product report this morning. Coming up, making your resume age-proof. We'll talk about that next.
Information to make cash and save cash. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
People over 50 looking for a job should consider age-proofing their resumes. Joining us with tips on how to do that is Rick Cobb, founder of the workplace consulting firm 2Discern in Chicago. Rick, thank you for joining us today. And when we talk about playing the age game when it comes to trying to find the new job, it's real and it's out there. And you see this on social media where people who are over 50 talk about how they can still be a positive contributor to an organization, that they're concerned that even if they're 51, 52, or 55, that they could be screened out by a much younger person in the recruiting department.
Yeah, that's true. You know, we all have biases, whether they're somewhat benign or more severe. And those biases can be overcome by only one thing, and that's personal experience. So you can say that you do or don't like a particular type of person or where they went to school or people of a certain age, but you'll have exceptions in your own life, and those will be because that person knows you and doesn't think of you in the same way they do generically about the rest of the class.
Now, what is the age bias when it comes to hiring, when you see the resume of somebody whose professional journey began in the 1990s? And if you're an HR person, you're saying, well, I don't want to hire somebody who has that level of experience. Are you concerned that that particular employee could be more expensive? Or do you lean back on the tired old tropes that that person may not have the ability to adapt to a changing workplace?
Yeah, I think both of those are accurate in terms of how they look at it. So if you've got someone who's got 20 plus years of experience in the workforce, either they have fallen from the height that they were at, or they cost more because they just cost more because they're used to getting that kind of income. Me saying income's not the issue for me, at least in the early process, the early filtering process, isn't going to be believed because it just doesn't seem to make any sense. So that's one thing. The other thing is that, yeah, the flexibility, the ability to adapt, which is why it's so critical. It doesn't, age is one thing, but in any situation, I don't have enough experience, whatever the bias is that it might exist that filters, it's a function of the filtering mechanism. And so you have to try to find a way to avoid the filtering mechanism as much as possible, because face-to-face, you're going to be able to defeat or combat the impression of who you are on paper. And you have more flexibility. The resume can't change its mind if it doesn't like its answer.
Now, this is something that you and I have talked about a great deal, and that is the key to landing a job, regardless of your age, is that you, as the candidate, have to solve the problem for the person making the hire. You have to demonstrate that you are going to check whatever boxes this person needs to accomplish their mission in any workplace. And it seems like that face-to-face connection is will help you defeat any AI applications that are out there.
Yeah. So for everyone who's looking at it, who's interviewing, the goal is to understand the person that you're talking to's wants and needs, and then try to align any of your experiences with what they seem to want or need. And if you can tell a story about it, that's great. That's absolute. But it's not about you. It's about them. What do they want? You can get past first date to second date and ultimately get proposal and marriage, but you have to go through the first, you have to jump through the first hoops. The other thing you're trying to do is avoid the people that are basically there to filter. You know, if I'm a recruiter at a low level, I'm doing phone screens, I'm looking at resumes, I'm trying to get the list of 1,000 resumes down to 10. Nowhere in that process is that person have the authority or even any interest in hiring you. So you're trying to get to the dance, and you're trying to get to the dance because they like the dance and you know what kind of dances they like.
And then very quickly, Rick, if your college graduation date starts with 19, or if your first job date begins with 19, should you lie or should you leave that number off? I mean, how do you confront the fact that you have been in the business for a couple of decades?
I think it's omission. You don't put your date of your graduation on. You know, if you've got a good school background, you put that on. Your academic experience is important. But anything that's happened in past the last 15 years, unless it's just absolutely monumental and unprecedented, you just leave out of your resume. No one's going to care about that. Most of the people that are looking at your resume and are even are going to hire you don't even know what happened 15 years ago.
Good advice. Rick Cobb, founder of the workplace consulting firm 2Discern in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, a basketball card being showcased at a convention in the Chicago area this week could be the most valuable ever sold.
Compounding your interest with an economy of words. This is the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
A rare dual autographed Kobe Bryant, Michael Jordan card up for for sale at the National Sports Collectors Convention in Rosemont this week could top $6 million, possibly becoming the most valuable basketball card ever sold. Joining us to discuss is Stephen Fischler, CEO of ComicConnect.com and Metropolis Comics in New York. Stephen, thank you for joining us today. And, you know, when I was a kid, the gold standard, Stephen, for valuable baseball cards or valuable sports cards in general was that Honus Wagner card that was well over 100 years old. Now we're talking about Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant. So this is a card from the 90s, and it could become the new record holder.
Well, you know, you're dealing with two iconic sports figures, obviously Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant, Kobe having passed away tragically. It really is a perfect combination of rarity, which is the only one they produced. It's got the original, parts from their iconic parts from their uniform. And there's a lot of collectors who go, this is a one of one. They made one. It's obviously incredibly rare. And these are legendary figures. So to be able to own this is for some people is it might be that they're an intense basketball fan. Another person might go, this is an incredible investment. But it all adds up to a simply fantastic, modern basketball card. And for a lot of people, they want to buy what they know. And they might not know who Honus Wagner was, but they certainly know who Michael Jordan is, and they certainly know Kobe Bryant. So it brings together quite a combination.
And this also speaks to the international appeal of the NBA, because Major League Baseball or baseball history, that's certainly more of an American sport appealing to American rich people. But the NBA is a global entity, and Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant are international figures. So that will probably entice more buyers from overseas.
Oh, absolutely. You have people from every country who is quite familiar with who these people are. And then the NBA has done a fantastic job of making their brand global. And as an example, there's going to be a global market for this particular card, as it should be. But I do think that it will probably do very, very well. I said I would like to be the owner of the person who originally got that card way back. But it's like buying a lottery ticket. You buy a lottery ticket. A lot of people are losers because they didn't get this card. There's one winner. That's how you look at this card. It's a race to see who could have gotten it back when it was originally produced. And it's going to be a race to see who could buy it today.
Stephen Fischler, CEO of ComicConnect.com and Metropolis Comics in New York. Thank you for joining us today. Still ahead in Personal Finance Wednesday, dealing with divorce after the age of 50.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon, I'm Rob Hart. Markets are mixed right now. And joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Tim Grisky, Senior Portfolio Strategist at Ingalls & Snyder in New York. Tim, thank you for joining us today. T-minus 28 minutes and counting, Tim, until the Fed announcement. And as investors and traders watch and wait for that Fed announcement about interest rates, you're going to see a lot of erratic market activity for the rest of the afternoon.
We will, Rob. We'll see the market volatile going into the Fed announcement. We don't expect any change in interest rates. Neither does the market here. The economy is doing well. And so there's no reason for the Fed to lower rates. A good economic environment is great for the markets.
Now, you have several Fed governors who have said publicly that it's time to cut, or at least it will be time to cut later this year. Now, are they doing this based on their interpretation of the data, or are they doing this to be first in line in case there is an opening at the top of the Fed before too long?
Probably a little bit of both. Every president historically, or almost everyone, has encouraged the Fed to lower rates. It's a boost to the economy, but it's also inflationary. And I think we have to watch out for that. I think the Fed is being smart by keeping rates unchanged. Eventually, rates should go down, but we're not there yet.
Now, when you say we're not there yet, if the Fed stands pat in July, and they most certainly will, does that mean we can start the clock on the announcement of an interest rate cut in September?
Well, the Fed has what they call two eases in their back pocket. In other words, they think they can lower interest rates probably a 0.5% and not overly impact the economy. I think they're going to take that slow, but it certainly could be effective later this year. And I think that's what the Fed is waiting for. They're waiting for real evidence that the economy needs a little boost.
And then what is your interpretation of the initial reading on second quarter gross domestic product? 3%, that was above analysts' expectations. But there were a lot of underlying trends driving that figure. What was your first reaction today?
Well, there is a lot of data behind that very strong second quarter GDP that might give us a bit of pause. But, right now, 3% is, a very good growth rate for the second quarter. Remember, this is just the first look at second quarter GDP. There are a number of adjustments that we'll see in subsequent months. Good news in general. Economists have raised forecasts recently following some of the trade data. This is a good number and much better than the first quarter, where we actually saw almost recessionary conditions.
And then very quickly, Tim, back to GDP and then the Fed's role with cutting interest rates. One of the Fed was roundly criticized for being late to the party to raise rates in the face of rising inflation at the end of 2021. Is there some concern either by analysts or inside the Federal Reserve itself that maybe they could be late to the party to cut as well?
I really don't think they are late at all. And if you look at economists really across the board, they don't think the Fed is going to cut or should cut right now. There are certainly some outliers there who think a cut is in order. But I think, we need to see real evidence that there's some slowing or potential slowing in the economy. And we're just not seeing that yet. There's no reason for the Fed to cut at this point.
Tim Grisky, Senior Portfolio Strategist, Ingalls & Snyder in New York. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next in Personal Finance Wednesday, keys to dealing with divorce in your gray years.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Personal Finance Wednesday. While divorce rates have been on the decline, so-called gray divorce rates involving people age 50 and older are increasing, and many are now being initiated by women. Joining us to discuss is Sherry Greco-Rikus, Regional Director of EP Wealth in Chicago. Sherry, thank you for joining us today. And this is another offshoot of people living longer, it seems, that once the kids are grown up and it's just you and the spouse in the house, a lot of people think that maybe, now it's time to start living for me. We raise the kids, and now it's time to embark on a new chapter on our own. But if you're at retirement or near retirement, that could significantly harm your long-term financial outlook.
Definitely. And I see that with my clients. A lot of women in their 50s are thinking, I've got 20, 30 good years. Do I want to stay in this marriage? And I think right now people are getting divorced a lot. It's not the old days where it was taboo. You can get divorced, but you need to look at both the emotional side and the financial side.
Well, and the emotional side could also drive the financial side, because if one party in the relationship really doesn't like the idea of getting a divorce, and they are very hurt by the idea of getting a divorce, they could very much make it financially painful.
Exactly. And I always say, whether you have a great marriage or maybe a rocky one, even if it's early, women, you need to understand your financial situation. There's a lot of red flags that can occur through the years of marriage that would really cause, and it could end in this divorce, but you need to be prepared financially. And there's some things like, if a spouse says, why do you even want to know about our financial situation? You never cared about it before. You should care about it. Maybe they don't include you in talks with financial professionals, the financial advisor, the accountant. Are they have their own credit card that you're not privy to, that you don't know what's on there? Have you seen the tax return? That's the roadmap of your finances. That includes what your assets are, what your liabilities, is there large interest expenses? Have you taken a credit report lately? Maybe you signed something early in your marriage that you weren't even aware of. So these are all things and red flags that you need to take care of even early in the marriage. So if emotionally you decide you want to get divorced, you're financially prepared for that.
When you start the divorce proceedings, you know, obviously any legal proceeding can be fairly expensive. If you're going to do this just from a money saving perspective, do you hire an attorney or do you seek out a mediator?
You know, I say you always need an attorney because the attorney is the one that will draft the divorce settlement agreement. But you could start with a mediator and you need to take the emotions out of it. So a mediator would be really good to start. And when I work with clients who are going through a divorce, the first thing is really what was the family budget? So knowledge is power. You need to know what was expenses when you were together and what would expenses be if you were apart and how will you be able to afford those expenses either through working or assets. So you need to understand all that and a mediator can help you. But too often I've seen that there's one spouse that just can't agree and the fees get larger and larger. And it would have been better for the married couple to have that money in their pocket than to pay the legal fees. But you definitely, definitely need a divorce attorney to document everything that a mediator will settle.
Sherry Greco-Rikas, Regional Director of EP Wealth in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today. Join us at this time tomorrow for Technology Thursday. And still to come, a sweet collaboration that defies corporate rules.
Money talks as the WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Oreo and Reese's, owned by corporate rivals, join forces in a rare snack mashup. We welcome in Phil Lempert, founder of SupermarketGuru.com, based in Los Angeles. Phil, what is driving these two snack rivals to team up on this one product outside of just developing a Oreo Reese's treat that is kryptonite to me personally?
Well, Rob, I got to tell you something. It's being driven by one thing, which is PR, and number two, the hope that they can make some money on this. I think that this is one of the stupidest ideas ever. We keep on seeing more brand extensions coming out of Oreo than ever before. If you remember about a year ago, you know, Oreo teamed up with Coca-Cola and they had, you know, the Oreo Coca-Cola zero sugar soda. And come on, we just don't need this. If I want to eat an Oreo, I'm going to eat an Oreo. But what the companies are saying is this is being driven by consumers, because what's happening is on YouTube and in social media, people are, you know, unscrewing that Oreo cookie and then putting, you know, Reese's peanut butter on top of it and then closing the cookie and then eating it up. But come on.
And on top of that, clearly you have Mondelez and Hershey's are two, you know, very fierce rivals in this particular space. Mm-hmm. So on one hand, this is already a major success. We're talking about it, and I'm sure people are talking about it on social media. But who makes money in this particular arrangement?
Well, you know, I don't know what their deal is, but it's probably more of a licensing deal than anything else. So I think that they'll both make a little bit of money, and they're both saying that these are permanent. Now, there's two products. One is the Reese's Oreo cup that replaces the typical chocolate on a Reese's cup for Oreos, milk chocolate, and the white cream. Then it's filled with peanut butter and Oreo cookie crumbs. And then on the Oreo side, it's basically, you know, the same as they did back in 2014. That was a cookie that used Reese's peanut butter, and it has cookie crumbs in the filling. So I think that both companies have a license deal. Both companies are going to put it through their distribution. But while they're saying it's permanent, it's going to be selling on their websites in the middle of August. It's supposed to hit stores in September. I don't think that this product is going to be around very long.
And then with these types of buzzworthy concoctions, I mean, we talked about the Oreo-flavored Coke Zero earlier on. Is this also designed to beat the loss in market share that's the end result of people taking GLP-1 drugs like Ozempic?
I think so. I think that all these food companies, Big Food, is trying to deal with how consumers are changing their behavior because of the GLP-1s. Absolutely. But the sales are down for these kinds of products. People are just not doing it. So coming up with another Me Too product like this just doesn't make sense. What the people at Mondelez should be doing is coming up with a healthier Oreo cookie. You know, GLP-1 users want protein. So as weird as it might sound, give us an Oreo that's higher in protein.
Phil Lempert, founder of SupermarketGuru.com in Los Angeles, thank you for joining us today.